I grasp the wheelie bin and drag it to the end of our close. Its wheels rumble on the pavement. There are 10 bungalows on our development, mostly inhabited by people who have too much time on their hands. I keep my head down as I walk my small suburban street. I don't want to see Mr. Chatterjee from next door with his irritating Highland White Terrier, which barks day and night. Neither do I want to hear the wispy voice of Sylvester Herbert from number 7, complaining about the birds defecating on his car. I bet you can imagine it, can't you? Me smiling and waving at my neighbours, all the while imagining what their skulls would look like on my wall. Remember when you used to do your homework at the kitchen table and I'd catch you staring into space? You'd tell me that you were in your mind palace, and I'd laugh and recommend you hit the books. Well, I have a mind palace too, and I've slowly been making it a reality. In my palace, there's a special place for each of my neighbor's skulls, but the pride of place goes to you. I wouldn't call it a shrine as such, but the glass cabinet I've assembled is big enough to house all of you.
Vic arrives about 5 minutes later. He's wearing a black tie, but you'd expect that, seeing as he's an undertaker, seeing as he's just come from his premises. But he's not wearing his full rig. He's wearing a fawn raincoat with a flat cap poking out of one of the pockets, as if he's aimed to pitch it right. He's just one of us. It ain't official business. It's different. "Morning," he says. I've been wondering what he'll have with him. So's Lenny, I dare say. Like I've had this picture of Vic opening the pub door and marching in all solemn with a little oak casket with brass fittings. But all he's carrying, under one arm, is a plain brown cardboard box, about a foot high and 6 inches square. He looks like a man who's been down to shops and bought a set of bathroom tiles. He parks himself on the stool next to Lenny, putting the box on the bar, unbuttoning his raincoat. "Fresh out," he says.
"Is that it, then?" Lenny says, looking. "Is that him?"
"Yes," Vic says. "What are we drinking?"
"What's inside?" Lenny says.
"What do you think?" Vic says. He twists the box round so we can see there's a white card sellotaped to one side. There's a date and a number and a name. Jack Arthur Dodds. Lenny says, "I mean, he ain't just in a box, is he?" By way of answering, Vic picks up the box and flips open the flaps at the top with his thumb. "Mine is a whiskey," he says. "I think it's a whiskey day."
Without warning, a group of imps burst into his cubicle, dwarfed by a large red bucket carried between them. As a well-drilled unit, they hopped onto the desk and doused the flames with the sand that the bucket contained. The lead imp strode to the front of the desk, pulling, as he did so, a small notepad from his back pocket with one hand and a pencil stub from behind his ear with the other. He drew himself up to his full 6-inch height, tutted officiously, licked the end of his pencil, and stood with the pencil hovering over his pad.
"Oh, dearie, dearie, dearie me," he said. "Handlicense fire in the cubicle, distraction of high tea property. We have been a naughty boy, haven't we?"
Legion looked at the diminutive figure in disbelief.
"Unlicensed fire? Unlicensed fire?" he said. "This is hell! The whole place is ablaze most of the time."
"Oh, yes," replied the little imp. "But them's licensed fires. Unlicensed fires is an altogether different kettle of bananas. Health and safety, you see. Though I can't say I cares much for elves myself on the whole. Untrustworthy blighters, you see."
Legion wasn't sure that he did.
"When fires is used in the pits for torture,"
the lead imp explained,
"it's all done under your control conditions, isn't it? Can't have people getting hurt unnecessarily now, can we?"
"But I thought that was the whole point of torment," said Legion. Hurting people.
Oh, yes, but that would be the necessary element of people getting hurt, wouldn't it? There's nothing unnecessary about torment.
Legion shook his head. This was all a bit hard to follow.
I suppose, he said.
And then on top of the fire,
the imp continued,
we've got the destruction of property.
But the computer was already broken.
Very difficult to prove, I should think, seeing as how you appear to have set fire to the evidence. No, I'm afraid I'm going to have to write you a ticket. Name?
You say Salva didn't have it easy. Can I ask in what way?
Well, you know, she wasn't quite right.
Sigvaldi's tone suggested he thought Hjörvar might be messing with him, leading him into a trap, perhaps.
Sadly, my brother and I know very little about Salva.
Hjörvar felt he had no alternative but to tell the truth. If he didn't, he might never find out what his sister's problems had been. He was clumsy in his dealings with people, and incapable of using cunning to elicit the information he wanted.
Could you maybe tell me what was wrong with her?
Oh, you'll have to ask somebody else, I'm afraid. As far as I know, she never got any kind of diagnosis. She just seemed to find life so difficult. She was always misbehaving, always screaming and crying. She couldn't talk, and she was backward in other ways too. I felt sorry for the poor little mite, for your mother too. She was left on her own a lot to cope with the three of you while your dad was away at sea, and it was awful. You could hear the poor girl screaming from next door. The noise was deafening when your mother put her outside to play in the garden. But, like I say, I don't know what was up with her. Only that something was very wrong. My wife and I had four children, some of them more difficult than others, but your sister was on a different scale. There was something very wrong there.
Everything seemed dangerous and unfamiliar, except the rock he was sitting on, which was solid. An exceptionally solid, dependable rock, with a bit of moss on it for extra comfort. So, when the rock shuddered and rose in the air, I can forgive him for screaming. I do forgive him. Poor Billy. Especially when the rock produced a long, inquiring neck with a scaly grey head at the end of it. Billy screamed, or yelled. I'll call it a high-pitched yell. Of the sort many mammals, particularly monkeys, make when they want to explain to their friends that they are in danger. It means, help me, or run away. Don't worry, said the monster. I won't eat you. Which only made Billy's mouth gape wider. He stared at the scaly head, and the head looked back at him. The two strangers examined one another, and slowly Billy began to relax. He had not been eaten. He had not even been bitten. The face that looked back at him wore a slight frown, but did not, I hope, seem unfriendly. The eyes blinked slowly.
What are you?
Stammered Billy. What do you think I am? Billy was not sure. He slid down and, stepping back 3 or 4 paces to take a better look, a very scientific thing to do, he gasped in admiration.
You're a tortoise.
And that is how we met. And so, at the end of my life, began a friendship as close, or perhaps even closer, than the one I had made at the beginning.